what's on your mind. I looked up and I said, Dad, I'm getting worried now that Stalin has the H-bomb. Well, it kind of blew him away. If that's all true, my father wouldn't lie. So it's been something that I've been dealing with all my life. I have no recollection of ever not being concerned about it. I've looked at information when it's come by. I've pursued the topic. I'm very thankful that within the last couple of years, thanks largely to my pastor, Lowell Erdahl, at the University Lutheran Church of Hope, we were able to find some meaningful expression to this. And I ended up being the Global Concerns Commissioner at the church. We started a new part of our constituted ministry. And in the last couple of years, we've been pursuing largely this topic quite intently. Now, what I'd like to do this afternoon, basically, is to establish a working vocabulary, present somewhat of a primer on nuclear war in the 1980s. At least, as we begin discussing this, we can have a common vocabulary, and we'll know a little bit about the concepts and the tools and the weapons and the decisions that relate to our current nuclear strategy. So we have a lot of data to get through in this hour. I'll try to move very quickly. I'd like, if you don't mind, to save a little time at the end for questions. I'm afraid it'd be very easy to get diverted. We will be nowhere near able to discuss at any length or any depth many of the topics that surround this issue. This is an overview, and I have to ask you to bear with me primarily for the amount of data and the numbers and all that kind of stuff. I'll try not to make that too boring. I've simplified it as much as I can, but there is a point below which, if you do not understand these things or haven't some idea of what's going on, it is very difficult to meaningfully discuss this issue. So that's what we're trying to do this afternoon. Okay, first of all, does anybody... Oh, here we go. Everybody can see the number up in the upper left-hand corner up there? Does anybody know what that number is? 53,000 is the number? Yeah. Very good. Now, does anybody know what that number represents? It's the number of nuclear warheads in the world as of July 1981. Okay? 53,000. I've got something else up there in terms of a visual aid. That's a clock. Does anybody know what that is? The doomsday clock. Do you know what it refers to? Exactly right. You're very sharp class today. You're doing real well. The doomsday clock is an indicator that is set up by the Union of Concerned Scientists, and every quarter they update this particular clock. Generally it runs between 15 minutes until midnight, midnight itself, midnight being the Holocaust. Right now they have the clock set at 4 minutes to midnight, and what they're trying to do is underscore the urgency of our understanding and relating to this particular aspect of our contemporary life at this time. This is the closest the clock has been to midnight since the missile crisis in 1962, and I don't think we have any appreciation yet for how close we were there. Okay, I'd like to start off with a few terms. The first one, I'll be starting very basic here, and I'm not trying to offend anybody by being too simple. I know many of you know many of the things I'm about to say, but I'd like to make sure that we all sort of understand the same things in the same way. Okay, nuclear weapons. A nuclear weapon is a weapon that uses one or two processes of nuclear reaction to create a tremendous amount of explosive force. Fission is the first, the fundamental level nuclear reaction, which is a breakdown of some highly unstable radioactive elements, generally uranium-235 or plutonium-238. The plutonium is generally the trigger. In this process, there's a tremendous amount of energy generated. Fusion is, in many ways, an opposite process. This is when hydrogen atoms bond together to form helium. And in that process, they lose about 1% of the mass to energy
for the same amount of weight, they're about 1,000 times as explosive or 1,000 times as powerful as a fission reaction. Most of our bombs these days are thermonuclear. The thermal refers to the heat that it is required to start the fusion reaction. So what it is, it's two bombs in one. It's a little atom bomb, like the first ones that exploded over Hiroshima, that's inside a larger bomb, which is primarily hydrogen. And the heat in there reaches well over 3 million degrees, which is what it takes to get the fusion reaction going. Okay? That whole bomb is surrounded by a ring of uranium-235. They found that this magnifies the explosive effect. It also magnifies the fallout. Okay. The way these weapons are measured as far as their yield is concerned is in two terms. One is kiloton and one is megaton. They refer to explosive yield related to tons of TNT. A kiloton is 1,000 tons of TNT, and a megaton is 1,000,000 tons of TNT. It's a little hard to imagine what those numbers really mean. The bomb that was dropped over Hiroshima, killed about 78,000 people and destroyed the city, was a 10-kiloton bomb. All right? The largest weapon in the current nuclear arsenal, which is a Russian weapon, is about 30 megatons, which is 30,000 times as big as a kiloton, or 3,000 times as big as the bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima. So when we talk about nuclear weapons, we're talking about a very wide variety of explosive and destructive powers. The smallest one is about 1 kiloton, okay? And those are battlefield weapons. So the next terms up there are strategic and tactical. They refer very simply to what the weapon is designed to do. Largely, it's a matter of range. Strategic weapons refer to broad strategies of all-out conflict. Okay? If we decide to go to war with the Russians to devastate their economy or vice versa, to destroy the country, these systems are called strategic systems. The tactical systems are generally referred to as battlefield weapons. They range, again, from the very small ones, actually to ones that are larger than some of our nuclear weapons. The major thing that decides the difference is the range, okay? It's a little bit of a problem here because we have weapons deployed in Europe, which we call tactical, which happen to have enough range to get well inside the Soviet Union. They call them strategic. There are no Soviet weapons except on submarines, which are the counterpart that can get into the United States. Okay, triad is the next term. Triad refers to how these missile systems are based. And that's the tripod, three legs of our particular nuclear arsenal are land, sea, and air. This is also true of the Soviet Union. I've put air and ground burst up there. For one reason, it's very important in understanding the consequences of a nuclear war. The explosions in Hiroshima and Nagasaki were air bursts. They went off about 500 yards above the surface of the ground. And as a result, there was not a tremendous fallout problem. Okay, the bombs were relatively dirty, but it didn't pick up a great cloud of dust and dirt. If the bomb is a ground burst, on the other hand, it can pick up a tremendous amount of ground, and in the process of the explosion, that becomes radioactive. It goes up as far as 80,000 feet into the atmosphere, and the winds can carry it thousands of miles. Right? So there's a tremendous difference in that particular thing. That'll also come up later and be more important. Okay. Next two sets of everything else here looks more or less like alphabet soup spilled all over the blackboard. There's a lot of initials and acronyms and things in military jargonese, which are not particularly complicated, but they can be a little bit confusing. ICBM is one I'm sure most of you are familiar with. It means intercontinental ballistic missile. All of these are land-based missiles. Okay? SLBM is a submarine-launched ballistic missile. Again, these are also strategic. They're not tactical. They're not battlefield. They're designed for the overall strategy. Okay. CEP, let's see if I got any experts in the crowd. Does anybody know what that is?
Good, then I can be the expert. Okay. CEP refers to circular error probability, which is a very, very important concept. It's something that will come up again and again as we begin understanding the hair-triggered holocaust, which is what all of this is leading up to. What it means, basically, is the shotgun pattern of target, the shotgun pattern that missiles are liable to get into when they land on a target. Right. If you take the clock up there and imagine that that is, say, a 600-foot diameter circle, all right, and you have a weapon system that within which 50% of the warheads would fall in that circle, okay? You'd say that that weapon has a circular error probability of 600 feet, okay? We'll be referring to CEP quite a bit throughout this, so it's kind of an important concept. It makes a lot of difference on what you think you can do with a weapon, okay? MRV, those three initials stand for multiple reentry vehicles. This was the first shotgun, and originally when they were put on nuclear weapons, they simply increased the likelihood of hitting the target because they dropped more warheads and roughly the same trajectory. So you increase your probability that one of them will hit. If you shoot 10 instead of one, you have 10 times as likelihood of hitting the target than if you hit one, especially if your accuracy is not very good. The next two words I want to talk about a little bit more. Yikes, time flies. One is MAD. MAD refers to mutually assured destruction. Okay? This has been, for many years, the stated policy of the American nuclear arsenal. Okay? Very simple system. It says, you do not dare attack us, because if you attack us, we will retaliate. Retaliate. With an awesome destruction of your country, all right? They deter our aggression in the same fashion. This whole system can be thought of as counter-value, which is to say that our weapons are aimed at things that are of great value to that society, like Leningrad and Moscow and Minsk, okay, and industrial centers. Counter-value and MAD has been our stated policy and still kind of is. However, basically that is into the category of the old system. It's a relatively unstable system. It does not allow very well for accident, but at least it does have one thing going for it, and that is that there is a time to make some decisions in that system. It works like this. If we are attacked, and Washington and Omaha and Tacoma, right, a few places like that are destroyed, the president can sit there and decide what to do. All right? He can decide to throw in the towel. He can decide to retaliate. It's an interesting logical problem because it only has, its only reason for existence is that it can never be used. Now, when we, our next session tomorrow, we'll be getting more into ironies, paradoxes, and problems. Madness, actually, is what we'll be getting into, and I'm going to save some of that because I want you to come back and hear it. It's very important stuff. But anyway, this has been the system. Now, it's interesting to note in the deterrent system that there are only 218 cities in the Soviet Union with a population of more than 100,000. Okay? According to Robert McNamara, in a report published in 1967, he concluded at that time that 100 nuclear warheads would be sufficient to kill at least 39 million Russians and decapacitate 59% of their industrial capability. In short, destroy the country probably forever. The problem with this system is that we have, in the United States, 9,000 strategic nuclear weapons and 22,000 tactical nuclear weapons. These are conservative estimates. They range from 11 to 9,000, depending a little bit on what's going on. I've taken in all of these, in all of the information that I'm going to present today, if there's been a dispute from relatively reliable sources, I've taken the conservative one because I don't want to quibble, okay? And at these numbers, it doesn't make a tremendous amount of difference, frankly. That's a quote from Henry Kissinger, by the way. So, basically that's what's been going on. In 1962, when we had a showdown with the Russians, where, as Robert Kennedy later stated, we were ready to do it, we were ready to go to nuclear war at that time, John Kennedy later said that had that been so, even the fruits of victory would have been ashes in our mouths. And that was in 1962. The weapons systems that they had at that time were awesome, but they're nowhere near what we have today. We've been continually producing weapons. We're still producing them at the rate of 3 to 5 warheads a day. That's part of the reason why it's hard to get a stable number, too, because it changes just about every day. Okay, moving right along. Next thing I'd like to do is outline very briefly what our current nuclear arsenal is. All right? Again, approximately 52,000 nuclear warheads are distributed between us and the USSR. You notice that the number up there is 53,000. We'll get back to that. In the strategic weapon systems, under the old triad, the land-based systems, first of all, we've got the intercontinental ballistic missiles. We have 1,054 of them. The Russians have 1,398 of them. 50% of our nuclear warheads are MIRVed. Okay, MIRV is one we talked about before, multiple independently targeted warheads. And so one missile can carry, generally there are three on most of our Minuteman missiles. About half of the Russians are MIRV too. I don't have exact figures on that. Our total warheads for the land-based missiles is 2,150. The Russians have about 4,500 nuclear warheads on their missiles. One very important fact about this is that this only represents 25% of the United States' strategic nuclear weapons. It represents 80% of the Russians' strategic nuclear weapons. They place much greater emphasis on the ICBMs. That fact, too, will become very important in the second half of this lecture. The sea leg is submarines is all we're talking about here. We don't have nuclear weapons at this time on our surface ships. We have 36 nuclear-powered submarines in our current fleet. 5 of these are Polaris submarines. They're the older ones, and 31 of them are Poseidon submarines, a little bit newer. Each of these submarines, by the way, has 16 missile tubes in it and is capable of destroying about 144 cities, each one of these submarines. Each one of these submarines also carries more firepower than everybody unleashed in World War II. A tremendous amount of power here. The Russians have 62 of these submarines. We have 656 missiles on ours, and most of them have 14 warheads apiece. They're relatively small, about 30 kiloton. The Russians have 950 missiles on their 62 submarines. One thing that, again, becomes important very soon is that well over half of our submarines are deployed at any given time, and only 15% of the Soviet submarines are. Basically, we're much better weapon builders than the Soviets. Our submarines are much more reliable. Our missiles are more accurate. And something that's, again, quite important in this discussion. One thing that is happening right now with our submarines, by the end of 1981, 12 of these submarines will be fitted with a new missile, which will be the Trident 1 missile. It will be again carrying 16 of these, and it will have 8 MIRVed warheads of 100 kilotons apiece. Very powerful. Okay, in the air. The United States has currently, and these are being retired, quite a few of these have been retired, but currently we have 316 B-52 bombers, and the Soviets have 140 Bear and Bison bombers. Now, frankly, I've never known whether they call them Bear and Bison or we did, but that's what they're called. Ours carry 20 gravity-fed or gravity-propelled nuclear bombs, and the Soviets only carry 2 on their bombers, but they're big. Okay. Now, I don't want to spend a lot of time today, simply because we don't have it, talking about tactical nuclear weapons. It's a whole other ballgame, very, very difficult to get through, and not perhaps all that necessary for our discussion today. But suffice it to say that we have 22,000 of these tactical nuclear weapons. The Soviets have 15,000. Most of these are, again, in Europe, but they're in other parts of the world as well. Trying to come up with some way to make all these numbers meaningful is very difficult because they're so large and there are so many of them. One simple way to remember what this means is that you and I and every other man, woman, and child on the surface of the earth has an allotment of 3 tons of TNT explosive power allotted to them. That's every one of the 4.2 billion people. In sheer tonnage, there's more explosive in the world right now than there is food. Okay. Well, that was fun. Now, moving right along. The second part of this lecture today is entitled The New Improved Nuclear War. That's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, as you may well imagine, but that is basically what we are being led to believe. Our military budget from 1947 till 1980 in 1976 dollars was about $2 trillion. And $1 trillion, by the way, if you need a little help on this, Ronald Reagan likes to say that $1 trillion is a stack of $1,000 bills 100 miles high. It's a lot of money. The projected military budget between now and 1986 is $1.5 to $1.8 trillion. It's almost as much. I should also mention that in that 1947 to 1980 period, our national security went from almost absolute, there was nobody in the world in 1947 who would take us on, to almost nothing. We are literally defenseless at this point from an attack from the Soviet Union or elsewhere, but the Soviet Union would be the only one who could pull it off at this time. The only thing that we really have technically in our defense right now is our faith in the sanity of the Kremlin. Pentagon officials don't particularly like to stress that, but it's true. If they decided to do it for whatever reason, sane or insane, there is absolutely nothing we can do to prevent it for $2 trillion. That's what we got. Okay, moving quickly on to the new age. There are some very important terms that relate to what actually has been happening for a little while, but is only evolving into official national policy. The main term that we'll discuss here is the term counterforce. Now, we talked about MAD, our MAD deterrence, as being counter value. That was weapons designed to basically against cities. Counterforce is weapons, our weapons, which are targeted on hard protected military targets in the Soviet Union. All right. What these are basically are weapons that are so powerful and so accurate that they could hit and destroy an enemy missile silo. All right. Now, right off the bat, that sounds pretty good. Kissinger again referred to this as a less bloodthirsty strategy than the counter-value strategy. There is a very, very grave danger in the entire counterforce syndrome, in that it permits the likelihood, or at least it makes thinkable, the idea of winning a nuclear war. It works like this. You have to strike first. You have to be confident that your missiles can hit the enemy silos and destroy all their weapons, just about all of their weapons. This includes their bombers and their submarines and everything else. You have to be sure you can pull it off. The whole reason for a counterforce system is an offensive system. It is designed only to fight a nuclear war. It is not designed to deter a nuclear war. There is simply no deterrent value in dropping a nuclear weapon on an empty missile silo. There has to be a missile in there. It has to be a first strike weapon. There are some other concepts. I'll touch on them now, get back to them when we look at the systems a little bit. One is called launch on warning, an offshoot of counterforce. If the enemy has it, and they do, we're no longer allowed the luxury of being able to sit back and wait and decide what our response is going to be to a nuclear attack. We only have one choice. If we're convinced that we are about to be attacked, that there are missiles in the air, all right, we have to fire off our missiles or they will be destroyed. Okay? Basically, this moves the entire nuclear ball game about, in my own rough estimate, about 10 times closer to happening than it was before. There was a period when we had a technical failure early in the 60s. We thought there were 200 bombers coming in from Russia. We deployed our bombers, which take 6 hours to get over there, and they were flying along, and finally, after 3 hours, we realized that this was a flock of geese. We stopped the bombers just short of the fail-safe point. If they had flown beyond that, there would have been no calling them back, and we would have had a nuclear war at that time. The current cycle under this system is 17 minutes. And I want to emphasize that. 17 minutes is not very long. The entire strategies right now are designed to make a decision and to retaliate within 17 minutes. By the time we get done here today, that 17 minutes is going to look like a luxuriously long amount of time because there are certain contingencies under which we don't even have that. Okay. The rationale for this system is called one of flexibility and selectivity. It supposedly allows us to have a variety of responses to a variety of situations. One of the main problems with that is we know from the SALT negotiations that the Soviet Union does not have such a contingency. They have basically an on-off switch on their nuclear arsenal. They fight an all-out war or nothing. A couple more terms that will become important here on the board. The term MARV, M-A-R-V. This is part of the new generation of nuclear weapons. It means multiple maneuverable reentry vehicle. It's a nasty little idea. The warhead, after when it's coming down through the atmosphere, guided by a satellite, will be able to fly a zigzag pattern, avoiding any interception, and be re-targeted in flight on a more precise landing, a more precise target. Okay? This will be accomplished by a system that is in the process of being deployed called NAVSTAR, N-A-V-S-T-A-R, it's on the board, Global Positioning Satellite System. Very complicated, very hairy technological system that allows a satellite to talk to the missile in progress. The computers chat about it a little bit. They take position readings off the stars, very accurate, and you end up with what's been called terminal guidance, guidance on the other end. The hope amongst many military planners is to be able to drop a nuclear weapon down the smokestack of any building that they choose. We're not quite there yet, but we're getting pretty close. Barry Goldwater likes to say that with one of the weapon systems, they expect to be able by 1986 to lob a 200 kiloton nuclear bomb in the men's room of the Kremlin. They're talking about an accuracy in that system of 10 feet at 2,000 nautical miles. Okay, what I'd like to do in the next little section is quickly go through The systems that the 1980s are going to, that we are planning to produce in the 1980s. The first one I'd like to mention is an improvement on the existing Minuteman missile system called the Mark 12A warhead. There will be three of these. They'll be 350 kilotons each. They'll have a circular error probability. In other words, 50% of them will be expected to be able to land within a circle of 600 feet. This makes them a counterforce weapon. It makes them powerful enough and close enough to knock out a missile silo with a probability of 72%. That increases, by the way, to 98% if you can get it down to a 300-foot CEP, which they're working on. We plan on adding 300 of these to our current arsenal. Okay, one system that any of you from Washington are probably familiar with, probably more familiar with than I am back in Minnesota. We worry more about some other things back there. But a very important system, very significant system coming up is the Trident missile system. An author, Robert Aldrich, worked on this system for a while, and he described it as the most lethal weapon ever built. It's a confusing system because it refers to three different things. Trident is a submarine, Trident is a missile, and Trident is another missile. So, I'll try and clarify that. The submarine is a tremendous technological achievement. Again, there is a certain amount of fascination with the toys and all this. The submarine will be 560 feet long, about 2 football fields. The first 9 or 10 will be based here in local Bangor, Washington, which, amongst other things, makes this area a prime target. It's very quiet. It's very fast. It's powered by a 90,000-horsepower nuclear engine. Now, interestingly enough, no one has ever really made a very good case for why these have to be fast. They can put them anywhere. They can sit there for months. And the weapons they're talking about putting in them will have a range of 6,000 nautical miles. So it's, well, again, they're a little, you know, but we'll get into all that tomorrow. You know, how these things come about is a fascinating story all of its own. Okay, these cost $1.2 billion apiece to build. Each one of these is capable of destroying 408 cities. One thing that Caspar Weinberger admitted to this year, many people believed it for some time, but all of this is under the control of a submarine commander. One of the myths that we'll deal with tomorrow is that the president all by himself, making a sober judgment, will be the one to decide whether or not we go into a nuclear war. It's nowhere near that clean, I'm afraid. There are 24 missile tubes in the Trident submarine. Okay, it's our plan, by the way, by 1990 to build 30 of these submarines. The missiles that the submarine will carry are the Trident 1, first of all. It's already been deployed, like I said, in 12 of our current submarines. And the Trident 2. Right. The Trident 1 has a 4,000-mile nautical range. It doubles the range of our current Poseidon missiles. It will drop 8 100-kiloton warheads with a circular error possibility of 800 feet. Not a very good counterforce weapon. The Trident 2, however, has a 6,000-mile nautical range. It will be a missile with 14 MARVed. We know what MARVs were, we just talked about that. 150 kiloton warhead, circular error probability of 300 feet, and for that size warhead, that circular error probability will give you a 92% chance of being sure that you've hit the target and destroyed it. Okay, the next major system is one that's been in the news quite a bit, especially lately, because 2 weeks ago, Ronald Reagan decided to go ahead with it. It's the MX missile. The MX is also a little bit confusing. It's also a little bit confusing because it stands for two things. First of all, it stands for a missile, and in common usage, it also stands for a missile basing system. And I'll try and clarify that a little bit. It shouldn't be too hard. The missile itself is a monster.
It's 71 feet long, 92 inches in diameter. It's three times as big as the Minuteman. It carries 10 of these 350 kiloton warheads, circular error probability of 300 feet. They plan on putting a 500 kiloton, a set of 10 500 kiloton warheads on it. It's the same circular error probability. With that size warhead and that circular error probability, you get a 98% assurance of hitting your target and destroying it. And with the 500 kiloton, you gain another whole percent. You get 99%. Okay. In the terminal guidance plans for this system, they're hoping for a circular error probability of 50 feet. You're talking about 50 feet with a weapon that will dig a crater about a quarter of a mile across and 300-400 feet deep and vaporize everything within a two-mile radius. That should be close enough. These missiles will cost the taxpayer $40 million apiece, and they expect to have 200 of the small ones, 10 350 kiloton, and 200 of the large ones by 1990. Now, the confusion is, we've been hearing so much about the basing system, the racetrack, and all that kind of stuff. This is just one idea for how to deploy the missile. The missile has been, the go-ahead has been given for the missile, but they have yet to make a decision on the basing mode. The most discussed basing mode, and the one that President Carter was in favor of, even though he once, when it was first described to him, he said, "That's the craziest idea I've ever heard in my life." He ended up going for it. We'll get to that tomorrow. But what they were talking about was a land-based missile system in Nevada and Utah, with would cover 24,000 square miles of land. It would require 10,000 new miles of road. There are only 40,000 miles of road, by the way, in the interstate system. The biggest truck you can have on the interstate system is 200,000 pounds. The vehicle that would drag these missiles around on this road would weigh 1 million pounds. The road itself would be a tremendous thing. They estimate it would take 1/4 of all of the cement producing capacity in the United States for 10 years to build it. The system is a fun one. I don't know if I want to get into describing it. I'm concerned about time here. But basically the idea was sort of a shell game. Each single missile would have 23 hardened shelters that it could be in at any one time. Okay, the truck would drive around and back into these systems, all right, and it might leave the missile, and it might not. And then it would drive out again and go to another one, and then another one. And if it left the missile, there's a tremendous amount of gadgetry that would be put on the truck instantly to simulate weight, simulate vibration, simulate radioactivity, simulate sound, all the detectors that the Soviets have up in their satellites, which we have over them, so that they would not, and also it's all under a cover, so you couldn't tell, so that would fool them into not knowing which one of the 23 silos the missile was in. It's been referred to as kind of a Rube Goldberg scheme. There's a lot of problems with it besides the obvious. The other thing about the system that's, it may actually end up not being built. There's been a tremendous groundswell of resistance in Nevada and in Utah. The Mormon Church has come out very strongly against this system on moral grounds. Both the senators and the governors from those states are strongly against it. It will be built in an area where the environment is so fragile that you can still see traces of the Pony Express Trail that was ran through there for only 1 year in the 1860s. Another thing about this system, and at the end of this, I hope once again I'd certainly entertain any disagreement on this, but according to the CIA, our missiles will be vulnerable to Russian missiles by 1983. That's when they'll have their counterforce program complete. The MX is to be deployed by 1986. It will be half done by 1988. By that time, that still will not have enough in place to make any difference whatsoever. It will be done by the early 1990s, by which time even if SALT II had been signed, the Soviets would be able to simply add more warheads to their existing missiles. It will be obsolete at the very latest by the year 2000. Many people think it would be obsolete by 1995. Right? For all of that, we get that for about $100 billion. There are two other possible basing modes. But I should explain the $100 billion figure. That's a little bit disputed. The Pentagon originally said it would cost $33 billion, and the General Accounting Office, which is a branch of the legislature, a branch of Congress, did their own calculations and said it would cost $60 billion just to deploy it. The $100 billion is a conservative estimate for a lifetime, you know, over the 10 or 12 years that this system would be useful. Okay. Finally, we get to the fourth major missile system to be deployed. It's called the cruise missile. Kind of a twisted terminology. It's been referred to as the fourth leg of the triad. Very interesting little system. Again, some of the things we'll talk about tomorrow, like policy follows technology, other things like that. This is a technological marvel, just plain a technological marvel. I've seen film of this particular missile in flight, and it's uncanny. They're small, pilotless, jet-powered, not even missiles. There are missiles, technically. But they're very, very similar, both in appearance and function, to the buzz bombs, the V-1s, that the Germans were using in World War II. The thing that makes them so remarkable is the guidance system. It's called SMAC, which stands for Scene Matching Area Correlation. They computer program the target with a little map inside of the cone of the missile. It has cameras on the bottom of it. As it flies over the terrain, it matches the terrain to the map inside. The missile is dropped at 45,000 feet, where it's very efficient to fly for a while. Then when it gets near the target, it drops very quickly to within 50 feet of the surface of the Earth and flies around trees, over mountains, around hills. It flies zigzag patterns. It flies, that's just the most amazing thing you've ever seen. And right now, they've tested their circular area probability with this particular weapon at 100 feet. The other thing about this little bomb, it's very small, 14 feet long, and 25 inches across, but it carries a 200 kiloton warhead. The probability of killing or knocking out your target with this weapon is 99 plus at this point. Big drawback is that it takes a couple hours to get there, which in the age of counterforce would be a weapon basically of the dead. There are actually two cruise missiles. One of them is a little longer. It's a 21-foot, which has a range of 1,500 nautical miles. The 14-foot one has a range of 650. The little ones are being planned to be deployed on B-52 bombers. You can tuck 20 of them under the wings of one B-52. And they're planning to do this. They want, they'd like to have 2,400 to 3,000 of these deployed by 1986. They're being billed as being relatively cheap at $1 million a piece. However, it's been estimated by the Pentagon that the whole program, you know, building them and the factories and retrofitting all the bombers and all that kind of stuff, will exceed $40 billion. They'd like eventually to have 6,000 of them, by the way. I'd like to bear in mind, again, there are 218 cities in Russia with a population of over 100,000. Okay. The other thing about the cruise missile is that it does cross all the triad lines. You can launch it from the ground. You can launch it from the air. You can launch it from ships. You can launch it from submarines. It's a very versatile weapon. Okay. Finally, we come to the hair trigger. And I'll be kind of brief on this. Basically, we're in a situation where an accident or a miscalculation or an act of terrorism or blackmail or confusion or malfunction or miscalculation, any number of things could throw us for a few minutes. And a few minutes is all it takes right now to get this going. I'll give you a good example. On November 11th, 1979, somebody made a mistake. They took a War Games tape and plunked it on the Launch-On Warning computer. All right? At this time, we had a 17-minute cycle. We got 6 minutes into it before the error was discovered. All right? They had already gone looking for the president to put him on the little plane, which sits about 3 minutes from the White House, and would allow him to run the nuclear war from the air. In short, we were about 11 minutes away from the Holocaust at that time. According to the Pentagon, I read this three places myself, I couldn't believe it. During 1979 and the first 6 months of 1980, they reported 147 false alarms in our early warning system. Four of these lasted long enough to get us into the countdown, into the 17-minute countdown. One of them went 3 minutes, the longest one went 6 minutes. Now, another thing I'd like to talk about very briefly is presidential judgment. The Deputy Secretary of Defense at one point a couple years ago was quoted this way. It says, you have to boil that circumstance down to scale. You can't bring a person in to this huge room full of maps and lay out all the strategy. You have to make it very simple. Basically, we do this with three colors, green, yellow, and red. The president looks down at the needle and will decide by how far that needle travels on their computer to make a decision. It's a little different kind of judgment than you might imagine. I'm going to make it even a little bit scarier. There's been another decision made in the last couple of years, the decision to put 108 Pershing 2 missiles into Western Europe. This has come up against a lot of resistance, by the way, in those countries. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Anyway, that system, along with the 464 ground-launched cruise missiles, which are also we are planning to deploy in Western Europe, are within 5 minutes of the Soviet Union. 5 minutes. And they don't like them a bit. Brezhnev offered to pull out 20,000 tanks from Western Europe if we wouldn't put them in. We said no, we put them in anyway. Okay, so that decision has been made. It was realized somewhere along the line in there that that's a two-way street. If we're 5 minutes from Leningrad, they're 5 minutes from us. To protect this particular weapon system, the current plan is to deploy a satellite whose function is to decide whether or not the Soviets have launched a nuclear attack against our Pershing missiles. It'll analyze this information for 3 minutes and make a decision with no human interference whatsoever to launch these missiles. I have a very good friend in Minneapolis. He's a professor at the Institute of Technology and worked many years in the weapons industries. He's recently written an article in Strategy, which is the journal that the generals sit down and read. I asked him about this system at a meeting a couple of months ago. He said, if they deploy that system, that is the end. Sooner or later, the system will fail. Okay, another thing I'd like to mention is that Soviet submarines are within 5 minutes of Washington, D.C. Their missiles are. And the whole complex, multi-billion-dollar 17-minute cycle, once again, may be insufficient. Tomorrow, we'll talk a little bit about what that nuclear war would look like, what it would mean in terms of our response, about the whole weapon system and whatnot. I used to tell people in these sessions that, you know, you got to bear in mind the technology that we are about to bank all of, perhaps, all of human life on the planet, certainly civilization as we know it, is the same technology that screws up your phone bill. I was very interested in April to read a little thing in the Minneapolis paper. It pointed out that Caspar Weinberger testified against the antitrust suit levied against AT&T because, he said, We need that corporation together because we depend on their computers to run our nuclear war. They are the same computers, not just the same technology. Okay, I'd like to leave you with one happy note, proliferation. The number up here is 53,000. The number that we have and the Soviets have is 52,000. The remaining 1,000 weapons are split amongst the other members of the nuclear club, which are Britain, France, India, and probably Israel, South Africa, Taiwan, and Pakistan. Now we only know for sure about, and China, I'm sorry. It gets to be very complicated when you start including these other people. It's very complicated as a two. One thing that we should think about when we realize that there's only 1,000 weapons there is that there are fewer than 1,000 cities in the northern hemisphere with a population greater than 50,000. Okay. So this basically wraps up session one. Tomorrow we'll learn a little bit about the nature of the beast, what kind of things perpetuate this, why we get into things like overkill. I mean, think about it. Bang your dead, bang your debtor. Come on. Okay. Basically, what drives that particular, our particular strategy, what drives the industry, and how these things work out. We'll learn about what might happen if a nuclear bomb, even a very, very little one, or even a conventional bomb, were to land on a medium-sized nuclear power plant. Okay? Little things like this. I'd be happy to entertain discussion. I've got 5 to 5 by my clock. Dinner's in 5 o'clock. Are there any quick questions? No. The question was, how many mistakes have the Russians had? We live in an open society, and the Russians live in a closed society. Much of what we know about Russian nuclear strategy and capability is from the SALT negotiations, when we actually had to sat down with them and make some decisions. They're not known for publicizing their mistakes. All right, that's a very good point. The question is their technology more prone or less prone to error? And once again, I don't have solid data on this at all, but I do know that their overall technological capability is inferior. I've seen control panels of Soviet systems, you know, on film and stuff, and they look primitive, you know. There's also a tremendously high alcoholism rate in the Soviet military forces, 33%. Any other quick questions before we go? Thank you very much for coming. I hope some of you can make it back tomorrow. All of this will lead up to a forum when you get a chance to feed back into this on Wednesday night. Thank you very much.